When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Two guys with no credentials. Reviewing Rolling
Stone 500 greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us once again on the Sound Logic Podcast. And today we're discussing album number 96 on Rolling Stone Magazine's Top 500 Greatest Albums list. This album is Automatic for the People by R.E.M.
This feels like a recurring theme, but when I'm thinking about a guest, I often will go to Facebook and type in the title of the album and see which of my friends are the biggest fans. Something sort of sobering happened this time. When I searched for Automatic for the People, I realized that someone named Michael Iafrady was a huge fan. Sadly, way back in May of 2021, Michael passed away. He had been fighting cancer for a number of years, and I was unable to reach out to him to ask him to be a guest. We had met a number of years ago at a conference for campus ministry types. He was there as a guest speaker to talk about faith and action, faith and protest, faith and engaging current issues. And I was there to talk about my work at Penn State University. We sort of connected immediately, realized that we both had some similarities in our love for music, in sort of committing ourselves to a faith-based peace stance, and just kind of like thinking outside the box. It was really heartbreaking to hear that he had passed. In the midst of doing that, digging into his love for REM and for this album in particular, I noticed a long thread with another friend of his. So Scott Williams is kind enough to join us here this evening. Scott is a much better friend of Michael than I ever was. But again, someone who connected because of shared interests, because of shared love. And off mic, before we were beginning tonight, I said just offhandedly, it seemed very easy to become a friend of Michael. It was like, it didn't take too many sentences before you suddenly felt like this engaging connection. And reading his obituary again today, I was thinking, oh man, this must just have been the way that he moved about the world. Whoever wrote his obituary wrote, he was a father, partner, son, brother, friend, activist, liberation theologian, singer, songwriter, musician, magician, artist, vegetarian, voice impersonator, advocate, bibliophile, writer, teacher, student, seeker, and punk. And I think, you know, we haven't really done this before, but sort of holding this episode in tribute to him tonight seems like a really special and fitting way to begin a conversation about Automatic for the People. That's long-winded, but I think important to say out loud and up front. Scott, we'd love to know a little bit more about who you are. We're kind of meeting in this podcast space for the first time. First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for your willingness to hang out with two guys you've never met before and to reflect and remember your friend and your mutual love and appreciation for this band and this album.
Yeah, I'll do my best. It's really great to meet you guys. And, you know, there are people who knew him better than I did, for sure. But it was really easy to get to know him. The obituary that you read from was read by his widow, Jocelyn, who was his wife at the time that he died, and the mother of two of his three daughters, who he loved incredibly. In fact, a couple of the most important times I spent with him was the times when his oldest daughter was participating in a thing in Morgantown called Pop Shop, which was just this really great program where you would get, you know, little kids together to basically do School of Rock type of stuff, like Jack Black School of Rock.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. And his daughter was a superstar in it. His daughter Hazel was a superstar in it, which isn't surprising because he was this tremendous musician. I mean, he switched seamlessly between banjo and bass and guitar. He was this amazing songwriter. And that list that Jocelyn wrote of his roles is pretty exhaustive and incredibly impressive. I mean, what I knew about him was that he was a theologian that I respected. He was a writer that I respected. He was an advocate and an activist that I respected. And he was a dad and he was a friend that I respected. He was an altogether remarkable man. Hmm. The way that you described his battle with cancer made it seem like it took longer than it did. It was so quick. Other people will know the timeline a little bit better than me, but I mean, he was diagnosed and within a year or to a year and a half, he was gone. We'd lost him. It was really a horror show. In fact, I learned via social media that he was gone, and I thought it was a mistake. You know, DM chat group made mention of a serious decline in his condition, and a couple days before he was fine, we thought. So I don't know, that's a big mistake. But then it turned out it was true. So you know, he was a tremendously great light, and also we lost him in such a precipitous way. Yeah. And others, you know, others were closer to him than I was, and the loss was more acute for them, but it was acute for me too. He was a great dude, and he loved R.E.M.
He loved R.E.M. and he loved this album. Before we get too much into the music and your shared appreciation, my appreciation, I'm curious if you can tell us just a little bit about who you are, Scott, for those who don't know you. Oh, sure. How do you introduce yourself these days?
Sure. So my name's Scott Williams. I'm an assistant professor of philosophy and religion at West Virginia Wesleyan College in Buchanan, West Virginia. I've been teaching there since 2018. I've been teaching undergrads in philosophy and religion since 2002, so for a long time. I'm also in the discernment process for priesthood in the Episcopal Church, so I'm perhaps on the path to becoming clergy. My wife is a United Methodist pastor. We've been married for coming up on 26 years, we live in North Central West Virginia, which is Central Appalachia. Got a couple of kids who are home with us now because school's out. One at Syracuse, mm-hmm. one at Duke. My daughter Emma is in the way that her old man is, dedicated to Appalachia and advocacy and justice advocacy within Appalachia. She's having an internship right now at Legal Aid of West Virginia.
Wow.
My wife works for the ACLU. She's the faith-based organizer in the state of West Virginia for the ACLU. So advocacy is a big part of our lives, or, you know, my wife's life and my daughter's life. And you know, Mikey inspired a lot of that.
Yeah, let's shift for just a minute. To set the backdrop for this album. So Automatic for the People is the 8th studio album from R.E.M., released October 5th, 1992. And Ben, you and I were not quite 10 years old, so maybe that explains why why we didn't know it when we were really when it came out. I've noticed this over the years about R.E.M. I have never really done a deep dive into R.E.M., although I'm very familiar with much of their radio music. I think pretty much all their songs and pretty much this album are always credited to all four members of the band. They're one of the, you see some bands who kind of go, well, this one was this guy, this one was this guy, this was these two. Yeah. But R.E.M. seems to always be Barry, Buck, Mills, and Stipe, you know, like always. Yep. So I like that. I think when we're kids, we always like to think that our favorite bands are all best friends. And sometimes, right. Like the people in the band, and sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's a job, it's work, it's, you know, people you do something with. But I really get the sense that these guys have a connection, which is cool. Okay, it charted number 2 in the U.S., went to number 4 in Canada, and number 1 in the U.K. So pretty good. Charted in 14 countries. And then we've heard this before. It recharted again when it was re-released in 2000 and 2017, which would have been the 25th anniversary. Sales, this is a pretty big number, more than 18 million worldwide. 4 times platinum in the U.S., 7 times platinum in the U.K. and Canada. We've talked about a few albums over 20 and one or two over 30 million, but 18 million is quite a lot. I had no idea that this album had been that as commercially, like I knew REM's great and this is a good album. But I'm sure it right. did well. 18 million, I was much more than I thought before kind of looking into it. So very, very commercially successful. Wow, just incredible. I'm still trying to get over it.
I wonder if it helps that there have been a couple of re-releases too. I know we always talk about how things chart yeah. again. When you do these anniversary editions and bonus tracks and things like that, I'm sure that helps pad those stats a little bit. The hardcore fans have to have every single one that comes out.
yeah,
right.
Each one.
Right. If Neil Young doesn't stop releasing live stuff from the 70s, I'm going to go yeah. bankrupt.
Okay, a couple of little notes here on the production of it. So the album that would become this, Automatic for the People, had its origins in the mixing sessions of their previous album, Out of Time, which was at Paisley Park Studios in December 1990. And they did demos for Drive, Try Not to Breathe, and Night Swimming. So when they got to record this one, they had already written and recorded a lot of it already, which is really interesting. We've heard that before too, where you have this amazing session, you release an album and you're like, we still got great stuff here, let's go.
Yeah.
Now the album name, and I always wondered about this, the album name refers to the motto of an Athens, Georgia soul food eatery called Weaver D's Delicious Fine Foods. Automatic for the People, that's their motto of that, that right. restaurant.
And I remember reading an interview with Stipe at the time where he explained it more fully, that the owner of the place was often behind the counter. And so if you asked for something, an extra condiment, a refill of soda, a riff on what you had ordered that was maybe a little bit off menu, this guy's standard response was automatic for the people. Like translation was, this is the service we provide, you know what I mean? And you don't have to think about it. It's automatic for the people. And I don't know why they applied that to the album, but that was the root. Like,
it's exactly awesome. What you want it to be.
Yeah.
That's awesome. While they're recording, the musicians themselves would often, they switch instruments around. Buck would play mandolin, Mills would play piano or organ, and Barry would play bass. Buck explained that writing without drums was productive for the band member, so they would do that without percussion.
This is an important little note because of the way that they created it. The musicians okay. went off and essentially jammed on these various out of their comfort zones. But that's how they wound up with the demos that they then handed to Stipe to add lyrics to. Oh, so it was this interesting process of like separating themselves away from the guy who would eventually layer the vocals, sort of tinker with each other, push each other beyond what they're normally comfortable with. And then I think they wound up with 30 tracks and handed them back to Stipe. And some of them I think are very close to the original, like Night Swimming, which is just a piano with some strings. I think the piano is the piano from that demo that they recorded way back when that right. he added some vocals to, and we'll get into John Paul Jones, but he added some string arrangements and that was it.
It says the musicians would go off and
yeah.
Because I'm in the house with a very serious vocal student, when I read musicians, I think of a vocalist too. So I wasn't thinking that it would just be those three.
It seems like your comment about you want your bands to be best friends. It seems kind of cold to be like, okay, we're gonna go handle the music, you just go take a break for a while and we'll hand it to you when it's done.
Yeah. And by the way there's gonna be a Zeppelin dude involved.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was not MO. Like one of the sort of serendipitous things about the timing of this is that I just finished reading the Replacements biography called Trouble Boys, and the Replacements and REM were, so they were really tight with one another, especially Peter Buck and the primary songwriter of the Replacements, Paul Westerberg. And the Replacements never made it. They were completely drunken, out of control, unable to get along with the label. Huh. Like, they made amazing music, but they didn't make it. REM, who hung out with them, was part of the same scene, did make it. And to find them then later hanging out with a Led Zeppelin guy is like, you know, how are late 80s, early 90s punk sensibility guys hanging out with John Paul Jones? It's beautiful. it's beautiful, but Husker Du is mad, you know?
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about JPJ a little later. That's actually a good lead up to the next thing. So the album thematically deals with themes of loss, mourning. It's inspired by that sense of turning 30, which I guess sounds kind of funny to me now, but I get it. according to Buck, and the world that we'd been involved in had disappeared. The world of Husker Du and the Replacements, all that had gone, as you guys had just mentioned. We were just in a different place, and that worked its way out musically and lyrically. An excerpt from Pitchfork, reflecting on the album's 25th anniversary, which would have been 2017, we mentioned, rather than attempt to compete in a world where teen angst was all the rage, REM set about crafting a rueful response to the onset of middle age. Remind us that life goes on after your slam dancing days are over. And then this writer comments as well, if Kurt Cobain had survived into middle age, he probably would have wound up making a record that sounded like this. Heavy speculation, but very, very interesting. And that reflection of moving from that youthful recklessness almost to something different, we'll say.
Yeah.
Love to talk about the album cover, the artwork. Something we talk about every album. If you're not familiar, just pause this and Google the artwork for Automatic for the People. A black and white photograph of a strange object with block capitals, Automatic for the People, right at the top, centered, and then REM right in the middle, right on top of this image. And I'd never really investigated, but I've always wondered what this was. What is this thing? Well, it's a star ornament that was part of the sign for the Sinbad Motel on Biscayne Boulevard in Miami, near Criteria Studios, where the bulk of the album was recorded. Apparently the motel is still there, but the star is not, since it was damaged in a hurricane. So, again, I have no other information on, you know, other than that it was near the studio, if there's any other significance, because it doesn't, I always wondered if it had something to do with the title or the content, but or it's the 90s and we just took pictures of weird stuff.
With REM, inscrutability was always part of the appeal. In their earlier albums, like, you know, Murmur, their first album, the album cover is just a scene that's completely covered in kudzu, and the pictures of the band members are barely legible, and you can't hear any of the lyrics. You can't hear them. You can't understand them, because Murmur is a really good name for that album. He's mumbling. What did he say? I remember when they got popular, and I was mad about that they got popular, because I didn't think people deserved them. suddenly he became articulate, and some of his lyrics you could actually understand. And so when Automatic for the People came out, You know, you had to put work into it, right? When Automatic for the People came out, you're like, oh, good, an inscrutable cover. That's what we're looking for. And an inscrutable title. That's de rigueur for Aria.
Wow. It almost has a, someone has taken a photograph of that star and then cut it out with scissors. Like the graphic arts layering at the time, maybe it's just the techniques that we had in the 90s, makes it look like a bad copy paste job kind of. and the font is pretty unremarkable, but I think that does sort of lead to what you're saying, that like kind of mystery or something vaguely something else there about it.
When I was reading about it earlier this evening, I was like, it was the CD age. So yeah, I can brag that apparently I have a first edition CD. Ooh. And as somebody, somebody who loves vinyl, like, so I have a copy of the Rolling Stones Sticky Fingers with a zipper that actually works.
Oh yeah.
This is a treasure. Like, this is like, this is a first edition. When somebody tells me that the REM Automatic for the People first edition is constituted by a yellow background on the plastic, like, that's the most early 90s thing I've ever heard in my life.
That's awesome. I don't know if I have any of those.
A yellow background on inside, like where the disc was sitting?
Yeah. So usually CD cases, you know, the inside, is black.
Yep.
This one is translucent and there's a yellow piece of paper behind it. And that's how you know this is first edition. I mean, it's such a hilariously superficial understanding and plastic, literally plastic understanding of what constitutes first edition. That it made me giggle.
So now is why we're really here, although all that stuff is awesome. As we get into the music, Ben, pretty standard, like, almost, you know, I know it's CDs and tapes, so maybe not side A and side B, but almost exactly 24 minutes 15 seconds for the first six and the second six. 48. So it's like that, we've talked about that kind of sweet spot, 40 to 45 minutes, like the max that an LP would hold. This really fits that that model very well.
Sure does. And I, even though this was CD era, it's funny that I don't know where this comes from, if it's from being pressed on vinyl, but Wikipedia has names for the sides, which are really interesting. The drive side is side one and the ride side is side two.
Okay. All right.
Do you have any insight into that, Scott, as to why those names are there?
I tell my kids all the time, I mean, there really was nostalgia for this as CDs began to dominate. You know, you guys said you were 10 when this album came out. I was 20. I was 23 actually. And I was telling my kids the other day that the system where you bought the vinyl album and then you recorded it on blank cassette, you dubbed it onto a blank cassette, and then you had an at-home version and a portable version that you would put in your cassette deck in your car. Like, this system has never been improved upon. As far as they laugh, you know, I'm 1,000 years old, right? I mean, they claim. But in those days, people did come, like Tom Petty would come out with CDs with sides designated, like side one, side two. But you had bought the CD. There were no sides. But in the artist's imagination, there were sides.
Still creating in that way.
Organizing the sides of the album was part of the artistic expression. You put this on side one, you put that on side two. And sometimes, you know, like if you were into a band like Pink Floyd, like I was heavily, in those days, like sometimes side two was just one song. You know what I mean? It really, these sides matter. And I think the inertia of that bled into even up to 92. I was 23. You had young people who were still thinking in terms of sides, even though it was an antique idea at that point.
Oh, that's a helpful reminder. How young and old we are, I guess, that we we remember that moment in time too.
Yeah, and I never thought about it that way, but everything that these artists had grown up listening to and then producing, and even at 23, Scott, but all the music you had listened to growing up, you know, it's vinyl, it's the format that you were raised on. So it makes perfect sense. Yeah. I think even sometimes we'll still see like disc one, disc two kind of thing. And I think some artists still are searching for that structure in an age where you can release tracks whenever you want. Track by track, you got a good track, you can put it out. You can be successful with it. That doesn't have to be on an album, but people still want to release albums. I know, Ben, I've talked about this before. You're going to hate me, but my daughter is really into K-pop, and it's all about the package, the presentation. We went into a K-pop store at the mall, and there's just these sections. Each, it's not like HMV. It's like each panel on the wall was a different artist, and it's all their albums. You don't buy the CD, you buy the package. She was like, "We're gonna go. I'm gonna take you up for your birthday. We'll get some." She's like, "I want to get this album." I said, "Don't you have that one?" She goes, "Well, Dad, I have the CD, but I don't have the whole thing." Okay, well, show me. Let's get it. So we got it, and you know, and there's a photo book, and there's photo cards, and there's stickers, and there's. And it's like, it's this big, you know, it's like the size of, it's 8.5, like that's, so there's still this desire for something tangible, something that you can hold, you can put on the music and open up a book and read about the music or look at photos of the band. And I see, you know, in that genre, like the fans are 100% on board. They don't care that it costs $10, $20 more. They want the whole thing. You're just eating up all the content, which is to me fascinating in the internet age, where if you want a picture of your favorite band, like you can have it at your fingertip, but there's still something different than holding it or putting it on your wall, putting it in your your phone case or whatever. Anyways, I digress, but I think there's a desire for that.
This is a lot of what made vinyl attractive. You know, there was a poster of the band that would fold out of the vinyl gatefold. Sometimes, like, I remember buying a Jethro Tull album that there was an actual newspaper that they had printed that would fall out of it. And then even when CDs started, thank God this wasteful packaging is over for every time you buy a CD. But the CD came in, the CD, like, plastic case came in a larger cardboard thing that reproduced the album cover. So all those original CDs, all the early CDs were CD reproductions of albums that had already been made. So you were buying Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club's Band, only you owned it, but now you're buying it on CD. And and it was like a 11x4 cardboard front. And I can remember collecting these things, cutting them out, collecting them, and putting them up in my room. Because these artifacts were part of my identity. Like, so when you walked into my dorm room at college, you could see who I was into, and it was part of who I was. And these physical artifacts were super important in expressing that.
And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it was because the stores at the time had all these really deep display cases. Vinyl, right? You couldn't put a CD in or it would get lost. So you had put a cardboard bottom on it.
Or super easily shoplifted. That was the other worry. If you just had a CD-sized case, then kids would come in and it was so much easier than an album. So you made them as tall as an album, not as wide as an album, but as tall. And a lot of times it was possible to produce a lot of the album art on that template. And then you would save that. Yeah.
Wow.
Scott, I have a hunch you'll be back as another guest, because you've already mentioned several bands that have made Mike's eyebrows go up here. So we'll have to bring you back at another time.
But
tell us about how you got connected with REM. Do you have early memories of them?
How close
to this album in particular was it?
It's crystal clear how I got into REM. I mean, crystalline. I was in junior high school. That's what we called it then. It wasn't middle school yet. Like 82. And I don't know if you guys had this in your life, but I had a friend who was the curator of cool. Like, I wasn't cool. but I really wanted to be cool. And I had this buddy who was the curator of cool music, and most of his music was punk and metal. Like, he introduced me to Nevermind the Bollocks. He introduced me to Motorhead. He introduced me to Iron Maiden. His mother was afraid we were Satanists. It was all in, all in Central Appalachia. And I remember all of a sudden, countless sleepovers at one another's houses. And all of a sudden, I remember really clearly one day he had REM's Murmur. And he was like, this is killer. You have to listen to this. And it was a complete departure from everything that we thought was cool. Like, there couldn't be a song that was longer than 2.5 minutes, then you were a sellout. There couldn't be a song that involved more than 3 instruments, so then you were a sellout. I mean, these were all our 8th grade judgments that were, we were dedicated to them. Suddenly we have this jingly, jangly, melodic, mumbling, but clearly intensely cool sound, and we were just enthralled with it. I remember just falling in love with it immediately. And every time an album came out, this lasted me from the time I was in middle school until I was in college. I graduated from high school in 1987, the year that Document came out. So that was their 5th album. And it was the first album that they scored a hit. And I was furious. I was for the first time on a college campus. With 25,000 of my best friends, and all of a sudden, from my 17/18-year-old point of view, people who did not deserve them and hadn't earned them were into REM. Like, your access to my thing was too easy. Like, I earned them. I listened to Fables of the Reconstruction. I listened to Life's Rich Pageant. By the way, which is my and Mikey's favorite REM album, is Life's Rich.
Oh, interesting.
But anyway, I mean, everybody's had this experience where there's a thing that you're into that others aren't into, it's not popular. Suddenly it becomes popular, you resent the popularity. By the time Automatic for the People came around, those of us who had that initial attitude had A, matured a little bit, and B, gotten used to it, that they were popular. But the great thing about Automatic for the People, and the stuff that you were talking about, Mike, really does name a good bit of it, is that it has a foot in both the worlds. It has a foot in those older, more clandestine, more hip, cool albums. But it's beginning to transition into, like, tonight when I was listening to it, before I started talking to you guys, I was just struck by how earnest it is. Now, the least cool thing in the world when you're 20, I mean, there's nothing less cool than being earnest. Like, right? But when you get to be the age those fellows were, you start thinking, you know what? Some things are true and worth saying, even if you just have to say them without gatekeepers, without saying you can only understand us if you're cool. It becomes more important to say, hey, everybody hurts. It becomes more important to say, don't throw your hand. It becomes more important to say, sweetness follows. You know, I mean, some of the lyrics on that album, as I was listening to it this evening, I was like, there's some stuff here that could be like on a Live, Laugh, Love nightmare. Right? But in 1992, this was a thing that, you know, I mean, at a certain point you reach an age where you have to say, you know, some stuff's true, even if it could appear on that poster. So yeah, that was my journey. It was, you know, I thought being into REM was my badge of hipness. And then when the WVU cheerleaders were also, you know, singing Stand in the Place Where You Live, I was like, oh, I have to give up this whole thing.
That's awesome.
But Automatic for the People had a foot in those old days that I loved so much, that were so compelling and so beautiful. And also in this maturity and new earnestness that was really moving.
I love that. Did you stick with it? Was this a band that you continued to buy every album that came out?
I always go back to REM. I don't go back to any album after Automatic for the People.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
I lost track of them for whatever reasons. I mean, I don't know what to point to, but I lost track of them after Automatic for the People. I bought Monster. As soon as it came out, I bought Monster and kind of listened to it one time and tried to like it. This is also not only about them growing up, but about me growing up.
Yeah.
Like by that time, I was 25 years old. I was thinking about how to get into graduate school. I wasn't only thinking about how to be cool and make sure I was into the most cool music on the earth. And, you know, one time through a CD, I was like, you know, okay. And I set it aside. And I never kind of drifted back to them. And so I'm basically unfamiliar with all their music after Automatic for the People, which is strange given how important all of their music, including Automatic for the People, is to me still. I still love it. And not just for nostalgic reasons. Some of it's nostalgic. I can't listen to Reckoning, their second album, without being taken back to college parties. You know, I mean, that was the soundtrack of every college party, it seemed, them and the Smiths. But it's not just nostalgia. It's also, you know, continuing to relate to them and see the worth of it. But at a certain point, I just moved on to other things. Yeah. But it wasn't because they got popular. I got used to that by the time this album came out. Yeah.
Mike, I was trying to figure out my origin story. And in the shared document that we have, I sort of ramble on about maybe it was in college, but this afternoon it dawned on me. I think that we went and saw the Jim Carrey movie Man on the Moon together.
I thought about that too.
REM's Man on the Moon plays, I think, a couple times throughout the movie.
Yeah,
and I think that was a crystallization point for me where I realized I liked REM enough that if I ever figured out what album that song was on, I'd pick it up. And I think that was what led me to, you know, randomly flipping through, finding that track on this album, pulling it out and diving in. Coincidentally, getting to college for me made me realize that some other friends that I was making also loved that song and that album. And I think it just sort of snowballed from there. I think I went a little bit more scattershot than you, Scott. Sort of realizing I love this album made me go in both directions and just sort of willy-nilly pick up REM albums. I don't think ever going back as far as the one that you and Michael hold most highly, and maybe I need to do that now. But never really felt as much joy in the others when I listened to them. And I don't think I did pull off Automatic for the People this week and put it in my CD player. It's a CD that I loved enough to take on cross-cultural to South Africa. And coincidentally, that CD, which was in a CD case, got stolen when I was mugged. And so I have a blank CD that I scribbled on, original copy stolen in South Africa, fall of 2004, whatever it was, 2003. And to sort of ease my copyright panic at the time, I guess. But it was dear enough to me to drag along on a semester abroad with my Discman. So, yeah. I was surprised, Mike, that this is brand new to you. Is that right? That you would obviously know a few of the singles, but not an album that you ever got into.
I've never... I have Out of Time.
Oh, okay.
And I got to be honest with you guys. I don't think I've listened to it more than twice. And I'm not sure what it is. I have nothing against REM at all. Like, I think I think they're great. For some reason, it's one of those bands, and there are many, that I've never been had this urge or been compelled to go, I'm going to listen to a bunch of albums, or I just never have. I've heard their stuff on the radio. I love it when it comes on. Like I said, got no problem with them. I've just never taken the time. So I've never listened to this album. That being said, I knew, you know, obviously the singles, but even the one, like, is Drive a single? We didn't talk about the singles. Usually we do. Like, there was a lot of songs I was like, oh, and even the ones I didn't know all sounded very familiar. And that was the theme for me as I listened to this music. I was like, this sounds, I mean, this is in my wheelhouse for like the genre that I like and the type of music that I like, the type of music I grew up with. And, you know, albums like Monster and the few that came after, when I was ingesting music, you know, Much Music, which is Canadian MTV, ingesting like 10 hours of that a day as a very solitary grade 9 and grade 10. That's when those albums were out, you know, those late 90s, 96, 98. I think they had some albums. So I was more familiar with that stuff than their stuff in the early 90s. When I was listening Ben to Man in the Moon, I had that same thought. I thought, you know, I was thinking about the movie, you know, they talk about Andy Kaufman. So, yeah, I remember seeing that in the theater. And also I was like, did I see that with Ben? Did we see that together?
I think so, yeah. I think
we did, and I'm pretty confident we did. I mean, I was a huge, I mean, the 90s, Jim Carrey was like, he was the best, you know? I was a perfect age for everything he was doing, his comedy. His
and
comedy.
He was Canadian.
And Canadian, his comedy. And then, of course, he starts doing these, you know, he does The Truman Show, and he does Man on the Moon, which are like still comedic, but also very serious as well. So
plus, we were venerating Andy Kaufman in those days. Like there was something about comedy in those days that we were like, oh, we were learning to honor these comedy great. There was something almost sacred about Andy Kaufman and that flick, yes. And Jim Carrey's honoring of him, mm-hmm. that we were all supposed to take very seriously at that particular cultural moment.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I remember sitting in it, Ben, and I don't know if it was just you and I, or if my dad was there, or someone was there, kind of thinking, this isn't exactly the movie I thought it would be. No. like, you know, thinking that it might just be a comedy. I didn't really know much about Andy Kaufman at that time. Right. I knew he was in a show called Taxi that was like on reruns that my parents watched, and my like older aunts and uncles, like that's all I knew. So, when I hear Man on the Moon, I think about that movie almost every time. And now, yeah, you were there. But again, the theme was very familiar sound, even the melodies, you know, a song is on the radio and a part of it is stored in your brain somewhere. I felt like that was happening. I was hearing a song that I didn't think I recognized going, boy, this is familiar. So that kept happening as I went through this whole album. And it was very, a very comfortable spot sonically for me. And I really, really, really enjoyed it. I listened to it probably 3 or 4 times back to back today while I was at work. Just like, yeah, I'm just going to keep going. Just going to keep replaying this. And it was, very, very, very comforting.
It's also a band that we would have grown up with, but a band that all members are still around, but not playing together anymore, which is kind of an interesting piece of this too. Most of the bands that are not together anymore, especially on this list, are broke up because of death, some kind of trauma, some kind of bad falling out, something like that. And that's not the case with these guys.
Well, you know, the Barry Bucknell Stipe thing that you referred to earlier, Ben, like way back at the beginning, where that was part of their politics, like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you knew from the beginning that this is radically egalitarian. Not only are we sharing credit 4 ways equally, but we're putting our names in alphabetical order. And, you know, I mean, clearly there's a division of labor when somebody's writing a song. It's obviously ludicrous to say that 4 guys equally wrote the song. That's
right.
That's not a thing. But they were committed to it in a way that was really inspiring to me when I was that age. I was like, look, we're committed to one another in a way that says we're going to divide the credit equally. Sometimes that will be unjust to you. Sometimes that will be unjust to me. But we're together. And we're bearing this burden together. We're reaping the rewards together. And that's where we are. And Barry Bucknell Stipe, you know, that became really important to me in terms of my identity. And like being into this band that did that was always really cool to me.
Scott, what is it about this album in particular that piqued this band for you, do you think?
Man, I was listening to Night Swimming this evening before we started talking, and I just... I mean, what do you do with art like that?
Yeah.
I mean, Night Swimming is my clear favorite on this album. It's hard for me to say that it's my favorite thing that REM ever did. That's different, but it's got to be in the conversation as much as I love them. Sometimes I don't even know what it means that the white tight forever drum cannot describe Night Swimming. But I know that it's moving to me. And, you know, my mom was an English teacher at our local high school, and she was the yearbook advisor. And in her English class, she wanted an example of imagist poetry. And of course, imagist poetry is where you just create an image. You're not trying to make a point. You're just trying to create an emotional response to the image that you've depicted. And I gave her not Night Swimming, but You Are the Everything, which is on a previous REM album. I was like, You Are the Everything is an example of imagist poetry from pop culture that your kids will relate to. And it was really effective. And then when Automatic for the People came out, I was like, oh my God, they've topped it in terms of in those terms. It creates this massive emotional response that's both nostalgia and longing and the dissatisfactions of nostalgia. You know, like, nostalgia is really dangerous. And one of the things that's great about REM and Automatic for the People is their appreciation for the power of nostalgia, but their awareness of how dangerous it is. I mean, you can't live there. It doesn't make you happy. And so Night Swimming does both of these things.
Yeah.
It throws you back to a time when you were young and you went skinny dipping. And it also assures you that throwing yourself back there won't resolve whatever you're going through right now. And yet also that it's beautiful to be a human being and to have these kinds of experiences. I mean, it's just click. Awesome piece of art.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
What a beautiful song. What a gorgeous piece.
And John Paul Jones, the orchestration, like John Paul Jones, here's why we have Led Zeppelin guy. Like, I love Led Zeppelin. I love Led Zeppelin, right? But I don't necessarily need Led Zeppelin in my REM albums.
Right.
But I was like, oh, here's why Led Zeppelin guy is here. That orchestration at the end that fades it out. I mean, that's good. Goodness. You know, you have to be sold not to be moved by this.
Yeah, John Paul Jones, like, you know, you listen to All of My Love, you know, and on all these orchestrations, and so many times, even when they did their big show at the O2 Arena, I mean, he plays organ as much as he plays bass in those shows. So anyways, that's, don't want to get sidetracked again. It's not difficult for me to do that.
But, you know, I'm pining for the moon. But what if there were two side by side in orbit around the fairer sun? I mean, Stipe is an underrated, you know, because he spent so many years mumbling and being inarticulate. He's an underrated lyricist. Just the description of the sun is fairer than the moon. And what if there were two? And
I haven't done this in a while. Is pull out a CD insert to see what the lyrics actually read. Was disappointed to learn this week that they're not present in the lyric book for Automatic for the People. It's a really 90s looking black and white spread of the band and a bunch of like random Too Cool for You poses, and no lyrics are included at all.
REM, it was four guys at the beach. Like, you're like, why are you sending me your vacation pictures? Because it's REM. It's like, oh, this is supposed to be meaningful. No, lyrics. Okay. You know, REM albums don't have lyrics. Like, on I forget whether it was Document or Out of Time, for the first time in all their albums, suddenly there was a lyric sheet. And I remember reading the Rolling Stone review of that album. They were like, can you believe it? There was a lyric sheet in this album. Because the inscrutability of Stipe's lyrics were part of the point. Like, listen to Radio Free. You have no idea what he's saying.
Right. Well, and I think it's Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight has continued to show up near the top of lists of the most misunderstood lyrics of all time. That that chorus that repeats over and over and over and over again is not a chorus that most people know what it's saying, which is which is quite wonderful. I think the line is actually, "Call me when you try to wake her up," said way right. too fast, and right. people think it's "Call me Jamaica" or something along those lines. That it struck me when you said, "I don't even know what he's saying, and I'm still pulled in by it." Mike and I have said many times we're not lyrics first kind of people.
But
I feel so wrapped up in this music, even though I often don't know what he's saying, and it makes me want to know what he's saying too. There's like that duality there too. You say you are lyrics first.
I am lyrics first. I was always lyrics first. Like before I ran into REM, I would buy a Pink Floyd album, and I would sit listening next to the turntable, reading every Roger Waters lyric because I was memorizing them. This was at the heart of it. And so then you would get to, come with you, and you're like, like the music was so compelling, and like Green Grow, it was worse earlier, like Green Grow the Rushes Ho, which is retrospectively on, this is on Fables of the Reconstruction. I know that that's about Guatemala and, you know, like American colonialism in Central America. I know that now. But at the time, like this was something you had to figure out. I hate to bang on about it, but when I was at Western University, I was suite mates with a guy who had been given a frat hazing assignment. And the assignment was this. You could either write down accurately the lyrics to Radio Free Europe by REM, or you could bring an 8 bag of marijuana to the next frat party. But you had to surmount one of those two hurdles. And of course, everybody bought dope. Like, because there's no way you can Europe as well. I mean,
that's hilarious.
That was Michael Stipe trademark. And so, yeah, I mean, what was shocking was Everybody Hurts, where he was saying, if the day is long, like you could understand what he was saying. What he was saying was so earnest and compassionate. And that was the weird thing about Automatic for the People. Hmm. Not the incomprehensible shit. Hell, that was de rigueur. But it was the earnest, hey, think about, look, we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. We're all headed towards death. Life is dark. So it wasn't like a shiny, happy album.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to say things to you in the midst of the darkness. Like, don't throw your hand. Hold on.
Yeah.
These were weird messages to come directly from Michael Stipe. And they told you that the fellas were getting older and wiser and even more interesting.
I love that.
So Mikey met Peter Buck.
Oh, wow.
One time. This was really important to him. And it was like a thing where you line up at a record store or something and Peter Buck signs your shit. And Mikey walked up to him and handed him the thing he wanted him to sign. And he said this was a really Mikey thing. He said, I want to thank you, man. I learned to play guitar on your songs. And Peter Buck said back to him, so did I, man. God bless you.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Mikey took heart in that like, you know, how bad, you know, like Mikey was a good guitar player, but I mean, you never think unless you're Eddie Van Halen, you don't right. think you're a good guitar player, but Mikey took heart from the fact that Peter Buck had also was learning as he went.
That's really cool.
And Buck was really kind to him.
I had forgotten just how much I love this album, and so I'm so glad that I don't have to pick a favorite track. Usually we ask our guests to pick two tracks for our Spotify playlist, our SoundLogic favorites. Scott, would you take the pleasure tonight of picking two songs for that ongoing playlist?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, I already talked a good bit about Night Swimming, and there's no question, Night Swimming is my favorite. The other one is Try Not to Breathe. Apparently, I just learned this today, that this was about the death of Stipe's grandmother.
Oh, okay, wow.
But I think it still tracks. I mean, when I was, you know, this is about a person who's trying to make themselves small and try to get out of the way. And yet at the same time are demanding that you see their existence as significant. Like, I will try not to breathe, but I have experienced things that you've never experienced, and I want you to remember that as I get out of the way. So it's at one and the same time this tremendous humility and recognition of mortality, and also an insistence that my existence here has been significant, and you're going to remember it. It's really beautiful. So those are the two for me that really do it.
I love that. Love that.
I wanted to, just before we move in the end, I wanted to add one more thing about the music. Boy, was I delighted to hear an oboe solo. I was listening and I heard, and I was like, what is that? That's not a violin, that's an oboe. Oh my goodness. You know, and I mean, it's,
is that Night Swimming, Mike?
I think it's Night Swimming, and I think I think she plays on several tracks, but I think the solo is Night Swimming. I love the sound of an oboe. It's just, it's a little softer than the clarinet. And I'm kind of a, Ben knows this, I was a band nerd, and I'm into jazz. Yeah. And, I mean, but you don't hear the oboe, like, it's not, you know, you think of jazz and big band, you've got Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman and the clarinet and all that stuff, and you don't hear oboe. It's such a beautiful sound, and fits so perfectly on that tune, which, as we mentioned, is just gorgeous. And I was like, that is one of the, except for maybe slide whistle, that's one of the last instruments I expected to hear on an REM. You know, you had the Stones and the Beatles do French horn solos. We've heard that. This was just really, really nice. So anyways, that was just another little nugget that I was like, wow, this is cool.
Somebody needs to cross the bassoon frontier. Then we'll really begin.
A bassoon and bass clarinet battle.
Something I found myself thinking this week as I was digging into this album a bit more was how much their sound is like the Tragically Hip, and wondered why it was that the Tragically Hip stayed so north of the border and REM has an album with 18 million copies sold. It's so interesting to me that the parallels between those two and the different trajectories of their respective careers.
Ben, if you don't mind, I have a story about that. I have a story about that exact thing. I can't believe you said that.
Okay. Please.
So when I was in seminary / grad school, I had this good buddy who was from Winnipeg. And he was always wearing a Tragically Hip shirt. And I was like, he was my age. I was like, who is that? He was like, they're huge in Canada. And I was like, okay. So, but I, you know, I trusted his musical taste and his taste in all kinds of other things too. And one time the Hip came to Raleigh. And so me and my buddy Chris from Winnipeg and our wives, we went to see, and it was in a bar. It was like in a club. And he said to me, he said, if we were in Canada, this would be an arena. Like, never. And so, of course, he was over the moon getting to be, you know, right that close to the Hip. And he said the exact thing you just said, Ben. He said, this is our Stipe.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only reason I freaked out when you started into that. Because I had my buddy from Winnipeg say exactly the same narration. Yeah. And it was hard.
Huh. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I saw another Canadian band that never made it anywhere in this side of the border, Sloan. I saw them at the 930 Club in D.C., and I think there was maybe 20 of us there. And if I had to do a poll, I bet most of us were Canadian. And so everyone there was singing along, but it was like a mostly empty venue. And I just thought, like, this is so strange.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. It was great. The show was great. But it could have fit in my garage.
That's awesome. Okay, so something that we like to ask along this journey is, how has something aged? What has aged well? What has not? And I'm curious what you guys think about this album. I found myself thinking similarly to a couple of the artists that we've talked about recently. Stipe's voice is pretty unique. I don't think he ever really sounded like his peers when he was making music in real time. So in some ways, they were always kind of outside the norm. And Scott, your comments about kind of being disappointed when they broke through and became huge, not something you were expecting, kind of makes me wonder, you know, what that means for an aging process. A band that was cool to be weird, maybe doesn't want to age well. There's also some cultural touchstones and references here of things from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that wind their way into his lyrics that I think, like, whew, my kids have no context for those. I struggle with them, and I'm, I was born a decade before this album came out. So I wonder if sometimes if the lyrical content is the thing here that has aged the worst. But he's also got authenticity and darkness and vulnerability in here that I think has just aged like a fine wine. Like, it's just gotten better, the coming of age kind of themes that are on this album. So I'm torn here. I'm curious what the two of you have to say about this question.
There's something about this, and I am struggling to put my finger on it. Maybe one of you guys can help me, that sounds like early 90s rock. And I can't, I feel like I struggle to describe it. I don't know if it's the organ, if it's the very consistent snare on the 2 and 4. I don't know. But it just sounds like that era of rock. And I know this sounds really obvious, but if in terms of it aging, we move through different eras, different generations of music and how music sounds, and that's fine and that's normal. So I don't say that to say that it's negative, mm-hmm. because I think this type of rock and roll, if you will, or alt rock or whatever we want to call this exactly, I think this still holds up as a baseline of just really solid music. I'll say just music. I could say rock music, be more specific, but just, it is solid music. It's good songwriting. It's excellent execution. There's arrangements and orchestrations here, which are fantastic. There's all these amazing things. So I think it's aged very, very well. There's nothing, sometimes you listen to something and you go, oh, that is so 80s or so 90s, or, oh man, the way they sing, this is so 1977, but we say it in a bad way. I don't feel like I need to say that for any of this. It's, you know, would a young person say, oh, dad, this is old person music? Yeah, maybe, but it doesn't bug me. it's fine. So I think it's aged very, very well, even though we can tell, we have a pretty good sense of when it's from. And these songs, like, okay, Everybody Hurts. I feel like every year there's a movie that has that, or a TV show that has it. So, like, everybody knows that song. Like, my kids probably know that song. So there's something very timeless about this. You're right, Ben. Michael Stipe, we've talked about this very recently. When you have someone who's so unique, this idea of has it aged well or not, like, it doesn't even matter, because it's like they live outside of
an alien.
out of a time period. A guy, you know, like a David Bowie or different people we've talked about. You know, Jimi Hendrix on guitar, for example, like,
Bruce
doesn't
Springsteen.
Matter.
He sounded just old even when he was young.
they live within their own thing. It's like when this music came out, it was unique.
Yeah.
So it's still, so this is like, again, it's main, as you talked about, they had evolved enough that it's mainstream enough that it was really widely accepted, but unique enough that it's still REM. And I don't think I really have any in this regard much negative to say about it at all in terms of the aforementioned aging process. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think two things. A lot of times that what animates Stipe is rooted in Cold War politics, American imperialism.
Okay.
That's that can feel bygone. Like even on Automatic for the People, I can't remember what song. Ignore Land. Ignore Land is animated by a set of politics that died in 19, not really, but I mean the specifics of it died in 1989. And so that can feel outdated, but I don't think it really, the themes aren't outdated. I mean, you know, imperialism, colonialism, unfortunately these things never go out of style. It still feels really relevant to me. I will say this. So I'm not a musicologist. I can't analyze it the way that you did, Mike, which was really interesting. but I will say this. Obviously with my kids are 21 and 19, and I want them to be slavishly obedient to all of the music that I was into, because I'm selfish in that way. And I don't know that they have any appreciation for REM in particular beyond the big ones that might, you know, like Everybody Hurts. Like I'm sure they can recognize Everybody Hurts. And they can recognize things that I've played around them. The word Smiths hardly came out of my mouth and they knew everything. I mean, like the Smiths are really important to them and have held up. And I think it's music. I think it's the music. The Smiths have held up for them in a way that REM didn't. And I don't know why. I have no idea why. The REM was way more important to me when I was young, when both of them were, you know, relevant. REM was way more important to me than the Smiths were, although I love the Smiths. But now, if the question is, are people in the next generation still listening to this music? I'm not sure that REM is having the staying power that some other bands I could think of have. And the Smiths are just an example. So
I like that's that. My two cents.
But I love them. I'll never get over loving them. Those first five, six, seven, eight. Yeah, the first eight REM albums, just like the first eight Springsteen albums. You know, they might save the world.
Well, the next question that we usually ask is: was this list position sound logic? Hence the name of this podcast. And we've been struggling with this for 96 albums here now. Scott, we don't expect you to be as invested in this ranking as we are, having gone through the 95 that came before, but how does this feel to you to have REM's first showing on this list here in the top 100? Does it seem like it should be higher, lower? I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I would have to see the whole list. Like, it is not my favorite. It is not my favorite REM album. So that's one thing I can say, that I can think of two REM albums at least that I would put higher than it. But I mean, that then we're into super granular subjective stuff. So that's all I got. I'll let you guys take care of that.
You say that as if this list isn't.
No, of course it's all subjective, but like this is a granularity of subjectivity, like which REM album should be 95. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah,
I was listening to this album and then doing the research thinking I think this should be higher. I think this should be ranked way higher, and thinking about the impact of, you know, like I said, a song like Everybody Hurts, you know, and the other hits, the success of it, the impact of, you know, so much music in the 90s, I'd say for the next 5 years, that sounds a lot like this, which comes from not just this album, but the albums, you know, Out of Time, I probably, you know, way more about the band, but I wouldn't go too back too much further. But this band and this album in particular has made a huge mark on 90s rock music and beyond. I think it should be quite a lot. And 18 million copies. I mean, come on, man. Like that's, yeah. I know that's not the only thing when we consider greatness, but I think it's something to consider. And that's a lot of sales. So I could see this up much closer to 50. I think that would be appropriate. REM is certainly a heavyweight in the rock scene in the 80s and 90s, certainly in the 90s as they achieved even more success, more notoriety, more popularity. I would have it higher, straight up.
I think that's the correct answer.
Thank you.
But I know that there's some strong bias in me in saying that. Like, I love this one so much. I remember feeling some similar thoughts when we got to Joshua Tree. Like, how is this not higher? Well, it's because I'm not the only one voting here, and there's probably a reason that it continues to be at this sort of slot. It has actually risen. It used to be 249 and is all the way up here to 96. So I don't know if it's we've talked about how much a list that came out in the pandemic has valued transparency, authenticity, being real. And this album certainly does that. So I don't know, maybe more people will gravitate to it because of those things. And certainly it's got a lot of fans given how many albums it sold. I would like to see it higher, but stylistically, alternative rock from the 90s isn't necessarily something that's like a cultural touchstone anymore in the same way that it was for our teenage years. So maybe I understand why it's just sneaked into the top 100, but I'd love to see it a little higher.
Well, these guys, this was like right before, you know, Mother Love Bone and Pearl Jam and all that was set to pop. It wasn't, everybody's nostalgic for the time when they were in their early 20s and the music of that time. But it was really interesting. I mean, like I said, the category 90s alt rock like almost bugs me because I don't even know, like, is that Nine Inch Nails and REM? Because that seems strange, like that they would be even more.
Counting Crows was touring this summer with Dashboard Confessional, and I thought, that doesn't make any sense. Like, in my head, those two don't go together, and yet I'm sure there's people our age who are nostalgia for both of those bands at the same time, and so sure, put them on the same bill. And but it's interesting. We talked about other placement for this album. It was 247 with the original 2003 list and 249. It fell two spots for the 2012 list and then jumps all the way up to the 96th spot here. There's one more album from REM on this list, and we won't take too long to get there. Another 70 spots here or so to get to 165, where they have 1983's Murmur. And then the 1987 album Document had been on the first two iterations of the list and then the coffee table book as well, but has fallen off. So if we ever make it through this list of 500, Mike, we'll go back and visit Document when we get to that. So
Another decade or so.
Scott, thank you so much for taking the time for honoring Michael in this way and for sharing your obvious love for music in general, but also specifically for REM and this album. It's been a real pleasure to get to know you a little bit, and hopefully our paths will continue to cross here as we continue forward.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for asking me to come on. I love REM. I loved Mikey very much. Mikey has music out there. under M. Iafrate and the Priesthood. He's got several albums, so if people want to check those out, that'd be great too, because he was a tremendous musician and he loved REM. So of course I hope I run into you guys again, and you know, thanks again for having me on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for sharing those things, sharing your time, Scott, and of course I'm sure our paths will cross again at some point.
Okay, great. That'd be great. All right.
Ben, why don't you tell us what we have coming up next week before we sign off here?
We sure have been pivoting a lot in terms of the genres in this block of 10 albums. We keep saying that at the end of each episode. We pivot from REM to number 97, which is Master of Puppets by Metallica, going from the 90s to 80s metal. So should be a fun journey.
Yeah. excited to talk to again, shift again. And once again, thank you, Ben. Thank you, Scott, for the conversation. Yeah. Thank you for listening to this. Until next time, we hope you continue to be well. We hope you take care of yourselves and those around you. And we certainly hope you'll join us again right here on the SoundLogic Podcast. Thanks, everyone. If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our SoundLogic Podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.